Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Today is my favorite day, Halloween, and I wanted to speak with the absolute scariest thing a creative person can think of, a critic. Critique is actually a necessary thing for an artist, a writer, for any creative person really, and for their audience. It does many things. For the creative themselves, a good bit of critical analysis can help them understand whether what they were trying to do is what they ended up doing, whether they were successful in their act of creation, what worked, what didn't, and what to do next time to help them get there. For the audience, it can help place the work they're viewing, reading, or listening to in the greater canon of artistic works. It compares and contrasts against the past and present field to understand where the work came from, to spot influences, to help the audience understand how this particular artist is contributing to the conversation in comparison with their peers. But when most of us think of critics, we don't think of any of that. We think professional hater. We think of people whose job it is to tear apart work, to savage years of an artist's life with a few taps at a keyboard after having looked at something for 5 minutes that may have taken the artist 5 years to create. To ruin a person's career. Gleefully, there are fewer and fewer real critics these days, which is kind of sad. When I speak to artists, screenwriters, and other creatives about the pressure of figuring out whose feedback to listen to, I'm often met with the refrain, you must only pay attention to the voices that matter. Those voices are oftentimes inclusive of critics, professional critics, that is, whose opinion means something to the artist and to the community the artist both wishes to be a part of and wishes to sell to. But there is no shortage of opinion. In 2023, Rotten Tomatoes and Goodreads have replaced the reading of a critical review in like a newspaper or magazine. If you want to know whether a movie is good or a book is worth picking up, you tap a couple of times on your phone to get a quick percentage and then base your judgment on that. If the critics side with you, they're right, and if they don't, they're wrong. What do they know? Jerry Saltz is one of the last real critics, the kind of critic that matters, whose voice is held in high esteem both by the art world and by the artists who make that world go round. He's been the senior art critic for New York Magazine since 2006. He also happens to be one of, if not the most, widely read critics in the world, possibly outranked by his wife. He is a former long-haul truck driver, a failed artist, and a Pulitzer Prize winner. And he is my guest today. We had a far-reaching discussion about what makes good art, the democratization of critique, and whether he really is just a professional hater. Here's Jerry Saltz. Jerry Saltz, welcome to Head on Fire. Thank you so much for being here. It is such an honor and a pleasure and a privilege to welcome you to my show.
And it's a huge privilege for me to be here too, Dawn. And I'm a huge, huge admirer of your work, and thanks for having me.
That's gonna go on my tombstone forever. Gonna put that on every jacket quote for every book I ever published forever. For people that don't know you or what it is that you do, please tell people who you are and what it is you do.
My name is Jerry Saltz. I'm an art critic. I'm the senior art critic at New York Magazine. And etc.
And of course, the etc. That he's too humble to mention is that he won the Pulitzer for criticism in 2018. You are breaking boundaries for being the first Pulitzer Prize winner that I've ever gotten to speak to. So
cool!
Yay!
Well, this is what it feels like, I guess. But yes, I won it in 2018.
Do you do anything special with the Pulitzer? When people come over for the first time to your home, do you walk them by your Pulitzer? Do you take your Pulitzer on walks with you and just casually lay it down at like Chipotle and just say, oh, hi, you know, I've got to make a dinner reservation. Oh, who is it for? It's for me and my Pulitzer.
That is a good idea, the last one. No, I keep it. I don't know if you have viewers, if they can see this, but I keep it on my keyboard, and it just reminds me that I could be fired, but I'll always have this little paperweight thing. So
That it is small, but it does look like it could cause damage if you poked somebody with it.
I thought I was going to win $100,000, and the night that they called me and shocked my wife and I by saying that I had won it, late that night I said, I think there's $100,000 with this. But of course, that is the Nobel.
Yeah,
And I looked
that's the
it up and
Nobel.
I think I got 10,000, which, God, that was welcome. And I loved it. So,
That's not nothing. That's not nothing.
no.
So you are kind of one of the last true like critics. Like when you think of, you know, anybody that's ever seen a movie, especially that takes place in the art world or the literary world or something, there's always that like critic, and he's usually walking around in like a tweed blazer and everybody hates him. And is simultaneously terrified of him and trying to impress him all at the same time. You're one of the last true like critics out there. It is a very unique conversation that I get to have with you. You know, we both come to the creative world from a you know, different sides of it. But I guess my first question to you is, from your perspective on things and in your storied career, what do you think art is? How do you know when you've made art? And how does a lay person know when they're looking at art and whether or not they're just looking at a toilet?
Well, as we all know, as every listener knows, that Duchamp made a urinal and turned it and called it art. And we'll talk about that later. What's interesting is that another artist much later, Sarah Lucas, made a toilet and called it art, because only men could use urinals. So we'll get to all of that. For me, in short, art is not a noun. It is not a thing. Art is a verb. Art is something that does something somehow to you. When we listen to Mozart, we never ask, what does Mozart mean? You never do that. We never do it with theater, really, and not even with dance and other arts or movies. It's always narrative, narrative, or they did this or they did that. Yet when it comes to art, it is so strangely silent that it either scares us, intimidates us, that we don't know what to think. I would just say that get very, very quiet inside. Very quiet and listen to your own reactions. And I think that viewers will really take an incredible journey with every idiotic object that you find can take you somewhere, and that place can take you to someplace else.
What was the idiotic object that got you into art? How did you come into this world?
I was in the Art Institute of Chicago. My mother brought me there when I was 10 years old and parked me there and left. I have no idea where she went. I was walking around the museum, utterly bored. I had come from this, I wish she drove us in from our suburb of Chicago, and I hated art. Or didn't know what it was. There was no art in my life. In any event, I was bored, wandering around, lost, I think, and started looking at a diptych. And the diptych had in one frame a man in a prison cell dressed in sort of biblical robes, and there was like people outside his prison cell talking to him. And on the other painting, his head was on the ground, and there was blood spurting everywhere, and there was somebody putting a head on a tray and a lot of other stuff going on. And the long story short is I started realizing after a while that this painting was trying to tell me something, like Scheherazade trying to save her life by building a narrative and then building into it suspense and not leaving you in a place that you understood that something had happened to me, and that I looked around and I realized everything in this museum could be telling me a story, and then had an even bigger revelation, realizing that the building in my city could be telling me a story, that my city in my state, that my state in my country, etc. So this was, for a 10-year-old, an enormous experience that I instantly forgot. And then a few months later, my mother killed herself. She committed suicide one Sunday morning. And I came home from Sunday school with my two younger brothers. And I noticed a lot of cars in front of our home. And I got home and I said to my father, "Where's mom?" And he said, "She's gone away." And I said, "When is she coming back?" He said, "Never." I said, "What are we doing with her car?" He stared at me in a way I'd never seen anybody stare. I went upstairs and I looked at very, very old people talking who suddenly got silent. And my mother was never spoken of or mentioned again for the rest of my life. There was no funeral. There was no memorial. There was no nothing. All I knew is I went to school the next day and my life was totally changed. How does that relate to looking at art? Somehow, and I have forgotten everything else about my mother, somehow this primal, insane experience that I had at the Art Institute of Chicago came back to me many years later, and I realized what had happened, and that was the first work of art, and it affects almost all of my taste today. It was made by an artist, a Renaissance artist from Italy called Giovanni di Paolo, and I still, every time I see one of his works, I can see it instantly. So that was my first time. What was your first work of art, Don, that told you, a poem, play, Power Rangers, whatever it was, that told you there was
something
more?
Now, you're not
going to
come for me with the Power Rangers, sir, because I was the biggest Power Rangers kid. No, for me, there was I had a few different introductions to the art world, Power Rangers. My grandmother was a painter, a really good one. She was one of those people that, I mean, she'd gone to art school, but, you know, she got married really young and started having kids really young, and is one of those kind of stories of, oh, if I hadn't had kids and if I hadn't had a, you know, if I hadn't gotten married, would I have been this great artist? Maybe, I don't know. But she certainly had the talent and the skill, and she painted all of her life. And after her death, I got a lot of her paintings and put them in my house. And I even have her sketchbooks. She painted all of us. She painted all the grandkids. She painted all of her kids. And I have the sketchbooks from the, and it's so interesting watching her hand figure out the math of the proportions of my face and the proportions of my brother's face and stuff. So that was my introduction to art. And then she would take me to art museums and stuff. And I didn't get it at the time. I didn't.
Where?
East Texas, you know, local art museums and little things. I didn't actually really get to see like a real art museum, like what people think of as art museums, until I moved here to Chicagoland and got to see the Art Institute, of course, and got to walk around and see, you know, world-class artists. And I was like, oh, wow, okay, this is a whole different thing. Poetry was a different story. I'm a writer. I was a poet first and foremost, and now I write other things and, you know, nonfiction and fiction and things like that. But I,
what was the first poem that reached you deep?
I was a precocious child, and the only answer that I know of, the first poet's name that I remember reading and going, wow, poetry is something, mm-hmm. was World War One wartime poet Wilfred Owen.
Wow.
Dulce et decorum est. I know. I was 10.
Wow.
Don't have a clue. I'm still not exactly sure I remember how that got into my hands, but I remember the poem, you know, Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, and it's sweet and seemly to die for one's country. And I remember I wrote this like I don't remember. It's a very long poem. I still have it. It's a very long handwritten poem. It's all in rhyming couplets that I was this soldier going to die in war. I was very precocious. And then from then, I fell in love with the beatniks. So Gregory Corso, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, all of them. Again, I'm in middle school. Why am I reading these? I do not know. And then I went on from there to have a deep and abiding love for Taylor Molly, Saul Williams, Stichen Chen, the great slam poets of the 90s and early 2000s, some of whom I've gotten to know and speak to. So yeah, but what I love about the art world and the poetry world is that, what they share is that a lot of people don't think it's for them.
They don't think
it's for them. The average person doesn't really think that these worlds are for them. You know, they can think of a few paintings, they can think of a few poems, maybe they know some Mary Oliver, maybe they've heard the name Amanda Gorman. I'm sure somebody somewhere has stumbled over a rupee car at some point. You can think of the Mona Lisa and the this and the that, the David and all of that. But a lot of people, when they think of art, especially modern art, contemporary art, things like that, they think, oh, it's splotches. I don't understand the splot. I'm sure it's art, but I don't understand how that's art. Yeah. You think of Rothko and you think of his panels.
Why is that, Don?
I'm asking your you. Art this is what I want to know.
Art
yeah.
Are the two arts that everybody goes, well, I think I love it, but I don't really get it.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder what our arts have in common. I love Wallace Stevens, but I always tell people, no matter what you do, do not read him, because it's not possible, I think, to understand whatever Wallace Stevens is saying. And yet how he says things, I find to be equal to somebody like Piero della Francesco, who is a great high Renaissance, early Renaissance Italian painter, who somehow frames things so perfect that they seem inviolate, that how it is, it must be, even though you don't know what the hell it is. And I have that with great art, that it somehow includes you by also being other. There's a huge otherness to poetry, and I think to painting or art, that can be hard to grasp, but I think really if people would just open themselves up to not understanding this shit, because you can't, that if you could just sort of experience it, like I was saying, I think you could have a great time with it, because we've all looked at Rembrandts in the museum mm-hmm. and thought, it's kind of brown. It's sort of brown. Why am I not responding? But what people do not realize when they're doing that is then dive into the brownness. Ask yourself, why is this painting so dark? What was it about Rembrandt, the subject matter, his time, how did his art darkened from a lot of the other art that was being made. Why, how, and all of these things you don't need to read books for. I think that, wouldn't you agree that it doesn't really help to read too many books about poetry? I mean, you can, and I've never found a good book about poetry. Have you?
No. And I've never really read a lot of good poems about poetry either. Sometimes, you know, the poets will get very self-referential, or they'll do that, you know, oh gosh, I am just this artist burdened by my art thing. And I remember freshman year of college, I was lucky enough to take a senior level poetry, creative writing poetry course. And a professor came in, and I think first week or so, he said, okay, there's a few rules of poetry. There aren't many rules, but there's a few of them. And one of them is that you get one poem about poetry. You get one.
That's
you
great.
Get to write one poem about poetry, and all the other poems have to be about something else, but you can have one.
In the art world, so many people make art about art. Mm-hmm. Does that still happen in the poetry world? Are there people that make tons of poems about poems? I think it's probably much rarer in your world.
I don't read those poets. If they do, I don't read them. I don't know what that right. says about me, if I'm a snob or something like that, but if they're writing poems about poems, I those don't come across my desk because I don't read them.
Who wrote the great line, poetry, I too hate it?
Probably me.
I think it might have been. You wrote it. I think Marianne Moore might have written it. But
I know one that a lot of people talk about is Billy Collins, talking about tying a poem to a chair. My students want to tie a poem to a chair. I'm sure I could recall the rest of the poem if we had more time, but you know, they want to tie a poem to the chair and, like, you know, force something out of it. I think that's what a lot of people don't understand, maybe, about visual art, about poetry, about just the creative field in general, is that there is some meaning to it that maybe creatives understand that the layperson doesn't, so they don't try to understand it. As a critic, I'm assuming, help bridge those gaps, help provide an explanation, help provide context for what it is that we are seeing, what it is that we are viewing. Is that how you view your role? How do you help people kind of step into that world through your own medium of criticism?
I hope that everybody listening to this is following me on Instagram at Jerry Saltz, where I will post every day like five or six idiot works of art. Of not idiot, bad, but just things that are catching my eye out there that aren't controlled by the gatekeepers. What we all have to understand, and I'm going a little far afield, so pull me back, is that only 1% of 1% of 1% of all artists are successful or make any money. Yet 99% of everything written, done, produced, sold, show is devoted to this tiny, tiny percent. I think that that's fine. I want all artists to be successful, the good, the bad, and the very bad. And you and I might be the very bad, but I don't want us to ever be broke, that we have these phony baloney jobs in the art world. All of us, everybody listening to this, that I want you to make money. But my job, as I've understood it, is yes, pay attention to that art, because some of it is very good. Most of it isn't. And to make those calls, and I'll get back to that in a second. But I actually felt that my role model was somebody like Sister Wendy. And many of your listeners won't know who that was. That was a nun who used to have a big TV show. Or Bob Ross, the painter of Happy Accidents. Trees. Yeah. I want to speak to a much, much wider audience. I might only be the 11th best art critic alive right now, but I wanted to be, and I am, the most read art critic. So what I'm trying to do is be a voice for not the voiceless, but whose voices aren't as loud, whose prices aren't as high, whose careers aren't as enormous. And I actually think that while everyone worries about where are we culturally, that there's no work of art that can say 2023, I represent you, that many, many, many works of art are making these claims on us. And that's the role I hope I'm playing, at least.
I do want to ask you about a couple of things that you've said in the past. The first is that art history is not linear. Anybody that's taken any kind of like art history 101 or some kind of introductory art course at some point does think of art history as being linear, as you know, you start with the cave paintings and oh, this looks tiny and this looks weird and stuff, but this was actually the first time that we tried to draw perspective, and it's formed this way because we think that people were looking down at their bodies and that's how they sculpted it. And then, you know, it moves on to here, and then, you know, Roman, Greece and Europe, and then it trickles down to America, et cetera, et cetera. So we think of art history being this linear timeline where everybody was learning in leaps and bounds as this cohort of people that were all kind of improving our skills globally. What do you mean when you say art history is not linear?
I love art history. When something is made matters. All of that is a given to me, and I don't want to throw out art history. However, the art history that we tell ourselves is only the story of the winners. Many of the winners are very, very great. 85%, being very generous, 85% of the art that you see now is crap. However, 85% of the art being made in the High Renaissance in Italy was crap. We just never, ever, ever see it. It was not saved. It was lost. It's gone. So you only have a tiny fraction of what is being made at any time. Moreover, starting in the 19th century, one movement began, modernism began, and that each movement had to displace the movement before in a series of very exclusively white, male-dominated artists who would sort of take over from the last. By now, we realize that such a concept of cubism to fauvism to constructivism to surrealism to abstract expressionism to minimalism, an art trying to get more and more about itself, a pure, all of these ideas produced great art, but they excluded far, far, far more than they included, that in fact the idea is psychotic. It makes no sense except to people who believe the cult story. And then came postmodernism, which was so insecure about itself that it named itself after modernism, and that became a wreck. What we're now living through is the complete and total collapse of art history. And that makes it the greatest period of art history ever, by far. My one regret, Don, is that I won't live to see the beginning of the beginning of the beginning of the end of this new story of the apartheid that was practiced for 50,000 years by 49% of the population, on 51% of the population being women, we now know that 51% of all the handprints, that's me spitting on my hand, that's how those paintings were made. They didn't just paint with brushes and sticks and tools. They used their bodies. 51% of those handprints were by women. The story that we tell ourselves, that only men made art, was insane. And what am I trying to say? Women and the underrepresented, artists from Iceland, Estonia, where I'm from, Africa, Asia, everywhere, are now being permitted onto the stage. In other words, the stage is pretty fucking crowded right now. It is packed with a lot of people. And there's no, may I go on for a minute?
Of course.
Okay. There's no question. Everybody goes, but Jerry, you know, especially in secret, they'll kind of go, Jerry, this means a lot of mediocrity is getting through. And I always go, yes. A lot of mediocrity is getting through. A lot of mediocrity always got through. I'm sure that's true in the poetry world, in the theater world, blah, blah. I had 10 chances. 10 chances. If I were a black female, would I get 10 chances to stop fucking up and start again? Men are given chances. No one else is given chances. In the end, all I want to say is that quality and what people think is good will rise to the top. It will always happen. I could name 1,000 artists that no one has ever heard of that were pretty big deals 20 years ago, who were making $1 million for a painting. And that now, if I said their name, you would go, I don't know who that is. The stakes seem high, but they're much bigger than just money. And so I feel like now is a fantastic, fantastic time to be in the art world. And I'm thrilled to be watching more, however, from the sideline. I'm 71 years old. I can't stay up late anymore. I try. I'm invited to every opening and every dinner. Thank fucking God. Okay. But I'm not very social. I hate seated dinners. I sit next to you and I'll go, what shows have you seen? And you'll be, none. And I will just sit there for 2 hours. I won't say a word because I don't have anything to talk about. I only have my life. And my life is seeing 25 to 30 shows a week. That's what my life is. Where was I going with that? And that's it. I forgot where I was going, but it seemed to be heading up somewhere.
Well, I'd like to actually kind of, you were talking about, you know, what is your job and what is your life and seeing all of these shows. I do kind of want to talk about the unique job of being a critic for a moment. Because, you know, like
a dying breed.
When a lot of people think of critics or they see a critic depicted in the movie, it's always that little, so I feel like there's a lot of tweed jackets and there's a lot of fear and everybody wants to impress them and they're also terrified of them and they hate them, but they also need them and love them. There's this impression of critics that they are themselves cynics, that nothing is ever really good enough for them. In tandem with that is this idea that criticism itself takes away from the pleasure and enjoyment of art. Do you think that that's true? Do you think that that is a fair and valid critique of criticism itself as a medium?
Two questions. Let me try to answer both. The first, a lot of criticism is written in a high jargon gobbledygook language that I believe is intended to keep readers out. That I don't even understand it. I've never missed an issue of our school newspaper in the art world, which is Art Forum. And yet, I don't think I've read more than 10 articles in 20 years. They always seem to be about very good or bad, important things, but you can't read them. Moreover, a lot of museum labels are this long, 2 feet long, and they say what the art wants to be, but they never say, really, what is it? How was it made? And in a sentence or one sentence, what was the idea? Just in a sentence, that's all. Instead, it goes on to say, I'm interceding in the Estonian diaspora by this and that. And none of it makes sense. And it reduces everybody to fearfulness. And what was the second part of the question I wanted to answer?
That there's this idea that criticism takes away from the pleasure and enjoyment of art.
Bullshit is what I would say. The reason is, everybody always says, when I don't like something, why did you write about it, Jerry? No one ever says that to a sports writer who doesn't like her team, or a food critic who didn't like the meal, or a wine critic who had quibbles with the wine, or a movie critic who didn't like the movie. Only art critics get this. And I would say, loosen your fucking sphincters. I'm just trying to say, what do I like and why, and what seemed lacking and why? By comparing art to other art, by comparing art to itself, by your art to your own art, by looking at it as an object, as a thing that does something. It doesn't take away, and it doesn't make art. It's just an idiotic idea. I just think the critics have to start writing in plain, accessible language. Yes, art and poetry. Art is very complex. My own writing gets too purple and it's a mess, and I read it and I can't believe how awful it is. I just think that, just try to mention the artist's name in the first sentence. Try to describe the damn work. Try to talk about what it's made out of and then what you think of that. If you do those four things in your 900 words, your 200 words, your 1500, etc., I think you'll get, then you can go on and do a whole bunch of other theorizing. But first, get to the point and make a judgment if you're not too afraid. I find that many, many art critics, critics everywhere, are now terrified of not liking something. Because they're going to get canceled. If I don't like women's work right now, I'm a misogynist. If I don't like a gay person's work, I'm homophobic.
Well, that's just true. That's
well, that is obvious. And what can I do about that? I try to listen. I never reject the idea. And I try to listen. And I do the best I can. Mm. But I do think that right now we're more afraid of each other than we are of anything else. And I think this is a temporary thing, but we're more afraid of each other than we are of the other side.
I understand a piece of that. I understand, when I critique a poet, I'll stick with that. when I critique a poet, it's as a poet to a poet, as, you know, looking at, you know, I've gotten away from using, oh, this is a bad poem, this is a good poem. I use mm-hmm. the language of successful. Is this a successful poem? Does the poet seem to understand what it is that they were writing? Does the reader seem to understand what is written on the page? And the third point, is there some kind of conversation happening between poet and reader? Any level of conversation. It could be that sort of divine domesticity of somebody like Mary Oliver. It could be that social, you know, cultural gut punch of a Saul Williams or a Taylor Molly. It could be that acerbic wit, you know, something like that. But is there something happening between the two? Successful poem. That's a successful poem. If ever it gets into the weeds of, well, the poet was just so insular and they just had so many feelings. You know, I had another writing professor tell me once that those are what he calls landscape poems. Of course, as a visual art person, you might scoff at this, but he said, have you ever looked at a landscape? Landscape painting. He said, a landscape is fine and you can have beautiful, detailed landscapes. But they're more to just, they don't say anything. It just mm-hmm. says, look at that. This was a place that I saw and I painted it. And he says, that's what some people do with their poetry or their writing or their short stories or something. They say, these are some feelings I had and I had to put them down on paper. I don't know that that's a thing that you need to have other people read. So sometimes, you know, that poet gets to you in their head, or sometimes the reader will read a poem and say, I have no idea what this says. I have no idea what's going on this page. There's clearly something happening here. There's a lot of metaphors. There's a lot of language. There's a lot of big words, and I don't know what any of it means. So then, of course, the poet and the reader can't have a conversation, so it doesn't make it successful. So I get a piece of that where it's like, well, you can't criticize this big name poet or this person because, well, that's inherently this, that, and the other. And I'm like, well, there's a piece of it where you can say, okay, I can criticize the poem from a structure of, is this a successful poem? Is this doing anything? Or is this just, you know, a bumper sticker?
I think that you're answering this much more articulate than I am. I didn't know one of the names you mentioned, so now I feel dumb. That shows you how little we all know about each other's worlds, but I actually think that part is fine for now, too.
You've said, you know, I do want to ask, you've said, just because I don't like your work doesn't mean your work is bad. It means I don't like your work.
Right.
And I think that that is fair. And I think that that would be fair and valid for most people. However,
it's
Pulitzer Prize winner, senior art critic for New York Magazine, Jerry Saltz, your opinion does actually have some bigger sway than my opinion. So doesn't your lack of enjoyment of someone's work mean more than somebody else's lack of enjoyment? Do you ever consider the fact that if I write this review and I shred this person's work, well, that might be the end of their career. they might not make. So what was that?
That is very fair, valid criticism and observation, that even though in my own head, Don, I'm just this guy who does nothing except wants to quit his job, who's terrified of writing, who every single week, and I have weekly deadlines and daily deadlines, every single day I think, well, I have to quit. I have nothing to say about this or, you know, this show or whatever show I'm looking at. And then I have to write it anyway. I think that I do accept that the scale that seems to have happened around my work precludes me going after any smaller artist. And that when I am negative now, I will only try to punch up. I will never punch down. For example, I just really bombed a video piece, but it was at the Museum of Modern Art. It was in the lobby. It cost way more than $1 million. The artist's name is Rafik. I can't remember his last name right now. Forgive me. And it packed in over 1 million viewers. So I felt that it was fine to go after that. And nevertheless, the entire digital art community bombed me for not getting it, for not liking AI, I don't know, whatever. And I just kept saying, if this, you won, I lost. I didn't get what I want. He shouldn't be showing at MoMA, but he is. And now MoMA just announced last week that they bought the piece.
Of course.
So it's even more successful.
Because the truth of the art world is that artists think that they're making art and critics think that they're commenting on art, and what's really happening is somebody somewhere's making money. That's actually the truth of the entire thing. It's in all the art capitalism. Yeah. Yes.
In the art world, that's generally true. I guess what I'm saying is criticism does not matter as much as people think it does. Hmm. And a very small level, if you lose a few collectors, because even if Jerry Salt says something, then were they really your collectors? Were these people that you really had in your camp? Most collectors only buy what other collectors have already bought because other collectors like them have already bought it. This is why when you see 90% of most collections, they look the exact same. I wouldn't know if I was in a house in Chicago, Beverly Hills, Berlin, London, New York, anywhere. They have the same art. And I always say to them, I don't like to go to people's homes, but when I say anything, I go, well, it seems good to me. You know, I hope you like it. I don't see your taste is what I'm not seeing. I'm just seeing what other people have deemed to be good. Anyway, so I don't know. I just reject those and do the best I can. Now, I live with my wife, whose name is Roberta Smith. She is the co-chief art critic for the New York Times. She is a 10 times better writer than I am. And I love my work, so I'm not self-deprecating. But she really, really looks and really writes about objects and what they do. If any critic has any semblance of any kind of power, she has it. And yet in our apartment, it's invisible to us. We never see it. We never witness it. And we never deny it. But it's not visible, this power that she has, and I think I have a sway.
On the flip side, I know a lot of people. I know a lot of creative people. They hear the word criticism or critique or something like that, and you know, the enemy of every artist is a critic. I believe strongly that I have become the writer that I have because I started receiving good quality critique at a very young age. My uncle was a...
You what?
I said I started receiving critique at a very young age. My uncle was an English teacher, and I would send him my poems, you know, when I was like 10, 11, 12 years old, and he would send me back written critique. And he said, oh, you know, this was good and this is not, and this is what you need to improve on, and here's a writer that you should be reading. And I'm 12 years old.
It's a miracle that this happened to you.
Oh, I kept it all. I have every single last one of them. I have it in a folder, and it is my treasured possession. But, you know, when I was a child and I understood what criticism, good quality criticism, was for, good critique, in my opinion, is helpful to an artist, a writer, a musician, to understand that perhaps what they were trying to do and what they ended up doing were two different things. And the best criticism can provide a pathway to getting there next time.
Beautiful. Beautifully said.
You are an award-winning critic. Do you have any tips for people on how to give good critique?
That's such a great question. I don't have an answer to that. I love what you're saying, though. And I would like to think, Don, that I practice that, that if I'm going to get negative, especially, that I've got to really fine parse and tune whatever it is that I'm going to say, to grant that I could be wrong and let the viewer in on that, or give the viewer and a reader an idea of how I progressed from disliking to liking or liking to the other way. That's all I've got for you, man, because I just love how you said it. And I don't know how I do what I do, but I just do it. I think all of us are that way, that we don't know what we're doing, but we know how to do it. And that underneath the criticism is a psychosis, not the giver of criticism, but the receiver. That means that you accept the criticism, you reject this, you accept that. And then at 3 in the morning, when you're up, sure that your work is bottomed out, that you're no good, that you really need to quit, I always think that every artist should just stop and go, but I'm a fucking genius. I can do whatever I want. And that will get you through every dark night of the soul. And that's all I've got. And that's what I do myself. I did it last night. Like, what can I do? I'm going to just do what I can do.
Do you think, because you say, oh, I might be wrong, I might have been wrong, do you ever look back at a piece or a show or an artist that you thought, oh, that was terrible, and you look back later and say, well, wow, I was wrong about that?
Yeah, I do. I have, and I always try to make it a point to return to that artist and try to track how that happened to me. Right now, I'm writing about a truly great artist. I don't throw these terms around much, but a woman named Tracy Emin. Do you know this name?
I don't.
Okay, she's British. She's, I think, 54. She was part of a gigantic takeover by the young British artists of the 1990s, who essentially de-islandized Great Britain. No one ever paid attention to it, and they put it on the map. While a lot, Damien Hirst would be one of those artists, or there are others. However, in America, Tracy Emin was completely ignored and written off as sort of an attention-grabbing shock your grandma artist, including by me. And it turns out, about 10 years ago or so, I started looking at her work, that she's a deeply great artist. And I'm trying to write about that now. And by the time this podcast comes out, you can read it in New York Magazine. So the long answer is yes, I do change my mind and I try to own up to that. I'm sure I don't always do it, but I try, either in my work or on my Instagram, and say, whoops, I got this one wrong, or I thought that was good, but it turned out to be bad. It goes both ways. It's 50-50.
I am interested in how criticism has evolved into the modern day. I mean, you know, once upon a time, criticism was the purview of a few people that worked for magazines or newspapers or something like that. People like you, a few people that could give their opinion and publish it to a platform. And then that meant things, you know.
That's out the window. Negative. That is out the window.
We have now democratized critique. And I'm not always sure it's a good thing. I'm not always sure it's a good thing. Because you get right. You get, like, in the writing world, you have good reads. You have good reads and you'll have 42,000 reviews on something. And it's you know, conversations that I have with my author friends are, well, now whose opinion matters? Like, how do you figure out whose opinion matters? And, you know, everybody kind of collectively agrees. Well, you know, if my colleagues, you know, people that I consider my colleagues, if other authors like it, if my editor, whose job it is to, you know, they're doing this professionally, if my editor likes it, if my agent likes it, if, you know, if I get a positive review from a critic in a magazine, that, you know, those opinions matter. Does every single last little opinion out here have to matter? No. Why? Because when you are the creative person and you're trying to create, you can't listen to absolutely everybody. Because then if there's 42,000 reviews on a work, you're trying to figure out a way to make 42,000 people happy. And you're not going to write that book. You are never going to write that book.
Yeah.
How do you think that the democratization of criticism has changed the way that we consume work? Do you think that it has made the nature of criticism better? Is it better that everybody everywhere with access to the internet has a voice? What do you think about the evolution of criticism?
You need to teach a gigantic course on this thing. You open up such great questions. I guess what I think is, I'm of a dying breed. The art critic like me and Roberta and a handful of others that I see my 25 to 30 shows, Roberta sees more, and then goes home and writes about it and publishes that in a highly read organ. That's out the window. That's gone. And we're the end of that. There won't be others. However, what I learn on my Instagram and on social media and everywhere else is, maybe in the future, everyone will be famous to 15 people. In the future, we all have a voice. How do you separate the good from the bad? I think that it might go back to that really simple thing that you said earlier. There are good reads and there are bad reads, meaning there are writers who seem to have a voice, and seem to have a voice that you can access, and whose judgments seem at least to agree with you or to disagree in an interesting way. I think now is a time for everybody to wear as many different hats as they want to wear. Anybody that says, no, you can't do this and that, or you have to stick to one thing, I would say that person is trying to hold you back and keep you down. I think we all have to assume the stage. If you want to put it on Instagram or YouTube or TikTok, Instagram is going to be forgotten. In a few years, I'll mention the word Instagram and people will go, oh yeah, I remember Instagram. And TikTok will be beginning to be phased out. And I'm too old to get onto TikTok, and I will have sat out.
You're not missing anything.
Oh, I so love it when I look at it, but I don't know how to work it. And you're amazing on it. And anyway, now's the time. Everybody's a soldier. This is an all-volunteer army. You're living in the best period of art history and an emergency. We are all living under PTSD. We are all in shock by the horrifying, and from my point of view, right-wing incursions on our rights, our lives, our bodies, our country, our world. That's my point of view. Half of you will disagree. Never listen to this again. And we need each other. We have to have this time with each other to argue. We shouldn't have to fear each other, but we will. And we do for now. I'm just saying, I don't know what I'm saying other than now matters. Everything we do matters, and we can do anything we want. And that's what's happened to art criticism. Criticism is changing the way we are changing, but it has to be understood in this long American night. And we are very, very dark right now. Do I think we'll survive? I don't even know. I don't know. I wonder, because it just takes, 40,000 votes in like Arizona or wherever to lose. And that's it. But then the other side would say that too. So all I can say is stay up late, hang out with your friends, never stop working. Always be, curious. Think you're a genius. Always make your work. And the worst thing that can ever happen to you is you lived a life in art. And that isn't so bad.
It's not
That's
so bad.
That's pretty great.
I am so curious because there is this disparity sometimes that'll happen. And the only thing that I can really think of off the top of my head is something like film reviews, where you'll go onto like a website, like a Rotten Tomatoes or something, and you'll see the critic score. The critics say that this is it's a terrible movie. It's a 10%. It's horrible. Hocus pocus. Terrible movie. Horrible movie. And yet, audience score, 98%. This is a universally beloved movie. The critics don't know anything. This is a fantastic movie. I don't know what the critics are thinking. And then you'll see it in the reverse. You'll see films that win all the Oscars. And oh God, it's just a universal, by every critic everywhere is just like, oh my gosh, this is revolutionizing cinema. This is revolutionizing the art world. This is incredible. And then the audience score is like a 10. And it's like, what was this? Was bad. This was awful. What happens, do you think, in those disparate times whenever critics and audiences cannot seem to agree? And who's right?
Well, first of all, I've listened to your criticism, your cultural criticism, and the thing that I reposted of yours, which was
the
on
Barbie
the Barbie
movie.
Astonishing, great criticism of calling out, is that too strong, of just weighing in on the negative. On Barbie. Okay. This really gets me going. I want to say this about film criticism, which is by far the most read form of criticism, because this ancient, probably dead art, it just gets the most of attention. That you never are getting criticism in film criticism, ever. All they do right now is right about the narrative. This happened, then that happened, then this happened. These are the actors. It looked cool. See this movie, or maybe don't. There's nothing in them. Music criticism, not much different. Theater criticism is insane because it's smaller. The stakes are higher. Art criticism is up for grabs. Poetry criticism, only the poets know.
Yeah.
I think there isn't an answer right now. Everybody's a critic. Everybody is valid. And you have to find your own people that you trust. And keep in mind, anybody that does happen to read me or reject me, I have no degrees. I never went to school. I tried to be an artist and I failed. I self-exiled. I became a long distance truck driver. I'm sorry to tell the story again. And in my late 30s, I was so miserable, so alone, so filled with envy of everyone else in the world. You have a better loft. You have a better apartment. How come you don't have this job? How come I have to work full time? Why do your parents give you money? I was being eaten alive by my envy. And I realized I had to do something or I was lost. And I taught myself to be an art critic. I'd never written a word in my life. I'm a terrible reader. It takes me forever to read books. And that's why I only read books in the accepted canon. I'm still working my way through. And I'm, you know, anyway. And I write the way I can write. I only ask that people make art the way they can do it. They read the way they can read. Nothing else is required of you other than you stay completely open and completely curious. And that's all I've got. That's it anymore. As I age out, or something, as I age, I realize I don't understand my culture as much. Every name you've named, I don't know. We haven't even started on movies and TVs. I don't even know how I still watch television. No one listening to this turns on their TV. I still take a half hour to find things on the Netflix, and I only watch documentaries and stuff. But I try to keep all that in mind when I'm writing, and that's it. Do I make any sense?
You do. You make a lot of sense.
So crazy to me.
No, not at all.
And your questions are so good. And I'm just
amazed.
Five
people listen to this show. Don't worry. It doesn't matter. Nobody's going to listen to this. Nobody listens to me.
That's what I tell myself. That's what you
No, it's very true. I've seen my subscriber numbers. They are low.
No, they're high.
It's very tiny.
You're huge.
How do you recommend that people improve their taste level? So much of experiencing art is experiencing a lot of art.
Yeah.
Because again, I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, how people think that it isn't for them, but they only, when they think of what isn't for them, they only see this narrow, very narrow view of the art world or the publishing world or something like that. How do you recommend that people improve their taste?
Wow. I'm going to give another grandpa answer that will sound like bromides to everybody, but here's what I think. Look and keep looking and keep looking and keep looking. If you post on TikTok or Instagram, take pictures of everything that interests you. Post what's interesting to you. Art need not be good or even bad. It need only be convincing. It need only to have a sense of authenticity. I post art that I don't like, but seems very authentic or like I say, convincing to me. I want everybody to not look at just one thing. I cannot stand art critics or that will say, well, I don't like figurative painting. And I always want to say, how do you know what you're going to like until you like it or dislike it? It's like shopping. You don't know what's going to surprise you while you're shopping, while you're fingering everything. How do you know you're not going to like painting? There's the critics who say, I don't like painting at all. Well, fuck off. Everybody in my world acts like, I've said this before, morticians and undertakers. The painting is dead. History is dead. The author is dead. The novel is dead. Poetry dies every year. All I would say
Well, that
is,
one might be true.
Yeah, that's true.
That one
poetry
might be true.
Is dead.
Poetry is dead.
It's so alive inside of us that it's the only place it has. Art lives outside of us on walls. It costs a lot of money. Almost everybody that looks at art is cynical. Every person now looks at art and goes, yeah, but that costs like $1 million or three. Right? So, and I too think that. And you have to try, and it's hard to separate or see through that filter. When you go to a gigantic gallery, I can only tell people, don't set that aside. Yes, you are seeing a gallery that the sun never sets on, that has 23 locations around the world, that has to keep them filled with 5 exhibitions in every space, every month, all the time, forever. And needless to say, much of it will be crap. See that filter, and then if you can still do it, otherwise get out of the art world, try to see through it. Try to see through to the individual objects and see what you like. Start to get a sense of your own taste. Everything you like is trying to tell you something about the mystery ship that is you. Everything, if you love porn, I met a photographer who loved porn. He could name the photographers that took pictures of every single thing, and they weren't signed. And I said, you have to put this in your work. If you like sewing, put that in your work. If you want to sew a button on your damn painting, do it. Try to see through the filters and try to see to yourself and your friends. And I promise you, you will have the most amazing life possible to live. You'll never suffer. You'll suffer always. That's a given. No one gets out of here alive, guys. But you'll have the best life on earth. I would not do anything different than I've done. I might take better care of my teeth and my hair, but other than that, not much.
Why do you think some artists just explode into the stratosphere? And I think of, and I, what's so curious is I when I thought of asking you this, the two people that came to mind were Van Gogh and Banksy. And what I think is so interesting about both of those is they share a unique quality in that they don't seem to get to personally enjoy the success, at least not public. Van Gogh was successful after his death, and nobody knows who Banksy is. At least, I don't know, maybe you do. You might be one of the few people that does. But why do some people just explode into ubiquity?
Okay. Let me try to explain Van Gogh, one of the greatest artists and one of the hardest artists. When you look at Van Gogh, Don, what do you see? Just name me which picture you're looking at.
Probably his self-portrait. Okay. One of the self-portraits.
Most people stop there.
Yeah.
What else are you seeing? One at a time. What else are you seeing? Okay, so now we've established you're seeing a self-portrait. Mm-hmm. Somebody told you that's the guy who painted it. Now, what else do you see on the canvas in your mind's eye?
Oh, gosh. The individual brushstrokes, he was very known for that. Yeah.
You are seeing every stroke. Mm-hmm. Is any stroke much more important than the rest of the strokes, or do they all have an oddly equal meaning and import?
I don't know.
I don't.
The answer
my answer is no, but I feel like I'm about to answer wrong.
You answered wrong. That all of the marks are more or less as important as all the other marks.
Yes, they seem to all be equal.
Right. So you're seeing a face, you're seeing marks. What else are you seeing?
Oh, his self-portraits always make me feel incredibly sad.
Okay. But that's subjective.
Oh, okay.
What else in your mind? Now eliminate the portrait.
The eyes.
No, Eliminate all subject matter. This is hard, but okay. Once you get to the answer, it's very simple. Eliminate the subject matter and just see the painting as if it were out of focus and upside down. What else do you see other than marks?
I mean, if I'm just out of focus,
Color.
Okay.
The miracle of color, undiluted, unmixed, used out of the tube virtually, raw, over and over. What else are you seeing? You're seeing texture. So you're seeing an object that is a picture of a man that you think is Van Gogh, that is on a canvas, that is itself and much, much more. It does not follow any laws of 2 or 3 point perspective. It is a vision. It is an object. That is what Van Gogh is. And I want every person who listens to me, when you see a very hard painting by Robert Ryman, nobody has to know this name, but he makes all white paintings. He painted in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. You are getting the same thing without subject matter. You're getting issues of how it was made, what it's made out of, in what came first, what came second, how it's done. I'm going to talk about Van Gogh. Van Gogh is the lifestyles of the rich and the not rich and very famous. Van Gogh was incredibly famous in his lifetime. Every artist in Paris, which is the art world back then, knew every painting Van Gogh painted. He was this crazy Dutchman who smelled and was obnoxious, who they all knew. And then he moves down to the south of France. Every single painting he made, they were aware of, and they really admired him. I'm sorry to go on, but you asked a critic. They really admired him. He showed in the best gallery on earth because his brother, Theo, worked at the biggest dealer in the world, in London. His work sold. He's sold one painting in his lifetime, but he died so young that he sold a painting very early, technically speaking, and he received a rave review from the Roberta Smith, you know, the most famous critic, in the New York Times, in the Paris paper at the time, and he lived to read that paper. When he cut his ear off, I'm sure he thought that was a bad idea after he did it. Van Gogh was very famous and very poor. Banksy, on the other hand, is an artist whose work is very, very, very clear. He's making graffiti that doesn't look like any other graffiti. And he's doing it anonymously, and he's commenting on two things mainly, society and other art. And this is what makes both of these artists very popular, that they get millions of hits because everyone has a sense of what they may be doing. Van Gogh unconsciously and Banksy consciously. I've written negative about Banksy because I find what he's doing is fun propaganda. But what I give him is that 99% of all graffiti is crap, because 99% of it looks the exact same. What I like about Banksy so much is he doesn't look like the same old day glow letters of names on walls. He took that and did something with it. Is it worth $1 million? Not to me. I'm at a big computer. I have two perfect perfect bootlegs of Banksy hanging right in my apartment. I'm so interested in him, and I don't need the aura of it being a real Banksy. I have many bootlegs of famous works of art. And the only rule I have for making them is that they would fool me and fool anybody, but I want you to sign your own name to them. And so I have a Van Gogh. I have so much great art here. It just lacks aura. The short answer to your question is they have convincing accessibility, clarity, and a power. One is a power I adore, and the other is a power I respect, and that would be Banksy. And you don't have to use any of this.
Using every word. You've seen a lot of styles come and go. You've seen a lot of artists come and go. You've seen a lot of changes happen in the art world in your storied career. When's the time you were genuinely surprised? When was the time you were genuinely just stunned by the work?
My life changed forever at the greatest paintings I have ever seen in my life when my wife were led into a crappy, not very big cave in southern France. You would never even have heard of it. It's called Neo, but it's not Nuix. And we were led into a cave with other overweight American tourists with fanny packs and told to hand over our flashlights. And I tried to hide mine, and my wife hit me and said, do what she said. And the French art historian pointed her beam at the walls all around me, and there was a gallery of paintings. And I saw cave paintings. I saw something much, much more, however. I saw people who observed the world. This was not just mumbo jumbo magic by male shamans who went into these caves. These were people who had looked at mammals for 100,000 years, and they had extraordinarily advanced picture-making technologies. They had created an operating system that could record what they saw onto a surface permanently, and that would be an accurate rendition of the world. They could record bison and IMAX and salmon and saber-toothed tigers and mammoths. They could record animals who you knew were in estrus or were, what's the opposite of estrus? Horny males. I can't remember what that's called. You could tell if they were
a fraternity. I believe you call it a fraternity.
A fraternity of males, estrus or something else. You could tell if they were, the bigger animals were closer to you in space. They had a perspective system. You could tell if they were curved around drinking water. You could tell if they were being preyed on, like I say, or they were predators. You could tell their age. You could tell their gender. These were the most accurate renditions I'd ever seen. The handprints told me much. And do you know what the third most common things rendered on the walls? Phalluses and vulvas. This tells us again that not only were women in the caves, but children were in the caves, and that we only have 1% of 1% of 1% of 1% of all the cave art ever made. Because once a cave is opened, that destroys the cave generally, that they have to be at one temperature and one humidity forever and ever in order to exist. If they get frozen one time, That's it. They begin to, and this is in 50,000 years. It made me understand that painting and art making practices had been here far longer than I ever anticipated. They made me understand that a species that lived before us, Neanderthal, made hand stone axes that I would consider beautiful, that were not only beautiful, but were made by tribes of Neanderthal meeting and exchanging. They had a material culture done where they would meet on the trade routes while they were chasing the fish or the game or whatever they were walking for. They would exchange materials and use your material to help fashion my material and to finish this long 15-minute diatribe. Some of them are painted. There's evidence that there was pigmentation on these stone hand axes. And it tells us that art is much bigger and much older and much deeper and more complicated, just like the first sounds were poetry, the first languages were song, that the first painting was face paint, that the first acting out, that the first all of it is really kind of amazing, and that it's still going on, and it will not stop until all of the problems art was invented to solve have been addressed. And that changed my life, and those paintings live inside of my cells to this minute. And I have that with contemporary art too. It can happen on anything. So that's my insanely long, unusable answer to art can change your world. It can change your life. All you have to do is just let it, big or small. I have had my life changed by a 1950s plastic curved modernist chair. It doesn't take much. It can be Lady Gaga. It can be Verde. It can be anything that lives inside of you that way. Give it agency, and it will take you away and change your life. And then you will change the world. I promise you, changing the world is very, very simple. It's just shocking how few people try.
Fine art, very beautiful works of art have been turned into all sorts of tote bags, drinking things, all of that. Do you have a favorite? Do you have a favorite thing where you've seen like some beautiful, just timeless work of art turned into a kitschy, kitschy tchotchke thing?
God, I love.
Has anything ever surprised you?
Well, I love tote bags. I want to do a show called Tote Modern, named after Tate Modern in Britain, where everyone puts their favorite art tote bag in, or that would be great. What are yours? Tell me some of yours. I have, I have fridge magnets. I love my fridge magnets. I love it all. I throw it all out. I have hundreds here, and then I throw them out. What do you like?
I've seen, I've seen a million tattoos and a million iterations of tattoos. I think I've seen where people will have somebody with very long hair will have like the Mona Lisa or something dyed into their hair.
Amazing.
I think that's so interesting. Yeah, when you can just be the art for a moment. I think that's so interesting.
I've written on people who get tattoos of actual works of famous art. And why don't you have any tattoos? If I had a tattoo,
me?
You would think I lost my center. I look at
I'm
you
terrified
as
of needles. And I know that I would regret it. There's no image that I have ever enjoyed enough that I wanted on my body forever.
I think that it is tribal, but I would love to understand tattoos. I love looking at them.
Terrified of needles. I don't. It scares me. No, thank you.
But most of the pictures I see on people's bodies are just like cartoons
sure.
or logos. And I love cartoons and logos as
I do,
much
I
as
have
I
a
love.
Lot of, I you know, a lot of my favorite artists and stuff, like I get a lot of prints and a couple
yeah.
of originals from things that I love. And, but
yes.
I couldn't ever put them on my body. I'd be terrified.
Well, I suggest that somebody address this issue and write about it and make art about it. Everything's interesting.
Jerry Salt, I've taken up so much of your time. It's been the honor of a lifetime to get to speak with you about art. If people would like to read more of your work, get more of you online, where can they do that?
I hope you'll follow me at least on Instagram, Jerry Salts. I read every fucking comment. I post, I get 500 comments, 300 of them are tearing me a new one every day. And I won't write back, but I will like every comment to show you I've read them. I try to DM regularly with 45,000 people. I try to stick. Please
I don't know how you do
me.
It.
I don't know
my
either.
DMs are a mess. I can't imagine what yours are like. That's good. Godspeed, sir.
I'm going to say goodbye and actually hang up because I'm wasted. And I'd love to see your grandmother's art another time if you promise me I can.
I will send you photos of it. Thank you so much. Thanks for
thank
being
you,
here, sir.
John. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
That is going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My eternal gratitude to Pulitzer Prize winning senior art critic for New York Magazine, Jerry Salts. And yes, I will continue to say Pulitzer Prize winner Jerry Salts forever and ever, because this is the first time I've ever interviewed a Pulitzer Prize winner before. It's pretty neat. I am still intimidated all of these many days later after having done so. If you like this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Consider sharing it with your friends on social media. That word of mouth is a very fantastic organic way to let other people like you, to let your friends know that you like this show. Or you could like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And while you're there, consider leaving a review. Reviews help recommend the show to other listeners like you. If you hate the ads at the beginning and end of each episode, consider joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and fun little goodies along the way. Earlier this month, they got to read the unpublished chapter on black magic from my book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft. So if you are somebody that would like to see what did not make it into my book, you could join my Patreon and you can read that chapter. Then you'll be like, hey, I get why this didn't make it in the final book. You could also, if you'd like, follow me on social media. I am at Head on Fire Pod everywhere. Thanks so much for tuning in and downloading the show. Thanks so much for telling your friends. Thanks so much for following along. I am going to go celebrate Halloween, but please remember to never stop seeking illumination like a man with his head on fire seeks water. Be well.